Letters.
On HS2, data centres, Vladimir Putin, academic research, the Holocaust, prosthetic limbs, and animals on a plane.
The government was off track.
From Tom Kelly, Director of Corporate Affairs at HS2, 2013 to 2019. Coleraine, Londonderry. Your analysis of the reasons for the problems surrounding HS2, a high-speed rail project between the south and north of England, sadly rings all too true, as do the lessons the country needs to learn. Horror Story, February 17th. The lessons include a more focused and less cumbersome planning system, less political dithering and interference, and a recognition that we do not have the necessary level of engineering experience and capability in Britain to deliver this kind of mega project. The central problem, however, is more fundamental. Within government, HS2 was primarily seen as a standalone transport project rather than as a means to tackle two of the country's most significant issues: regional inequality and low productivity. HS2 could have produced an agglomeration effect by making it easier and faster to travel and do business between our big towns and cities. But that kind of strategic clarity about the wider outcome of HS2 was largely missing, hence the piecemeal approach we have today. The main lesson, therefore, is the need to be clear about the core purpose that such projects are trying to achieve before they start, in order to build a national consensus that can stand the inevitable ups and downs of implementation.
Hot data.
From Andrew Bachman, Idaho National Laboratory, Milwaukee. Technology Quarterly, February 3rd, on the physical underpinnings of the Internet, tackled the need to decrease the carbon dioxide emissions of data centres as they expand in number and power consumption. One thing to note is that extreme heat events are beginning to force some data centres to throttle their performance or halt operations altogether in case they fry their processors. This pattern is guaranteed to worsen, probably causing disruption to the now essential internet and communications services. Perhaps we might want to invest in resilience in earnest.
Tucker Carlson's interview.
From Sebastian Voller, Bern, Switzerland. Some form of dislocation is the only possible explanation for why people in the West support Vladimir Putin. Backstory, February 17th. A strong identification with and advocacy for an ideology, country, or leader that diverges from one's own interests and values is indicative of transferred nationalism, a concept introduced by George Orwell in his essay Notes on Nationalism, published in 1945. Transferred nationalism causes individuals to become more dishonest and malignant in supporting their own native country, where they have genuine knowledge and experience. Despite championing liberty and democracy at home, they abandon their principles, literary preferences, and to some extent, their moral sense when engaging in debates on international affairs, often without even realizing it. Debates and TV interviews will not reduce these leanings, they will only continue to reinforce them. As Orwell suggested, countering these tendencies is possible, but it demands a sincere moral effort.
From Luca Danese, Rome. Far from being a senseless ramble by an out-of-touch crank, Mr. Putin's screed on Russian history in his interview with Tucker Carlson was a shrewd message for a different audience: the Russians. Mr. Putin managed the remarkable feat of sending two messages in the same interview to two audiences that will listen to different parts. Westerners may have listened to only short bits of the interview, but for Russians, who may have been the only ones to have watched the whole thing, recalling a millenarian history of endurance and overcoming foreign invaders who initially had the upper hand, such as the Mongols, Napoleon and the Nazis, is a powerful invitation to resist the hardships of the Ukrainian war, the hundreds of thousands of soldiers killed and wounded, and the total isolation of their country, just like their ancestors, who eventually prevailed.
Science for science sake.
From Adam Pellegrini, Associate Professor, University of Cambridge. Free Exchange, February 10th, made many strong points linking university research, patent production, and economic growth. Yet the column concluded that governments should curb their lavish public support for universities. In an uncertain world, basic science is all the more important. A focus on application can lead to short-term breakthroughs, certainly, but there is always a need for basic science, testing hypotheses of mechanistic theories, that may not have an immediate application but can lay the foundation for breakthroughs. Such examples include CRISPR gene editing and the general circulation models used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Funding isn't black or white. Grants that blend corporate and academic research or promote industry-academic collaborations are useful experiments.
The Banality of Evil.
From Paul Moss, London. Your excellent examination of Holocaust memorials, article Remembrance Row, February 10th, mentioned the superb exhibition at London's Imperial War Museum. Some might question whether a showcase on the Holocaust belongs in a war museum, suggesting, as it does, that the killing of 6 million Jews, as well as gypsies, homosexuals and other Nazi victims, was a crime committed as part of the Second World War. In fact, what makes this act of genocide so particularly horrifying is that it was carefully planned and carried out in cold blood, in areas where there was little or no fighting. A crime against humanity, yes, but not a war crime.
Arms and the Man.
From Robert Cecchio, Dunellen, New Jersey. The notion that a prosthetic limb need not mimic the missing arm or leg that it is replacing has a precedent in science fiction. Weird and Wonderful, February 3rd. Robert Heinlein wrote about the possibility of mission-specific prosthetics in his book The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, published in 1966, in which the main character uses multiple prosthetics to replace the part of his arm lost in a mining accident. He is described as having a dozen arms, each one optimized for a specific task, plus one that looks and feels like a flesh and bones arm. This arm was presumably for social occasions, when an arm with micromanipulators might not be appropriate.
I do believe it's true.
From Grant Walters, Ottawa. It comes as no surprise that zebras may panic when travelling on an aircraft. Article Snakes and Rhinos on a Plane, January 27th. As Paul Simon will tell you, they're known to be reactionaries.
From Thomas David Kehoe, Boulder, Colorado. When vultures are transported by air, are they allowed carry-on luggage?